Turning tragedy into productivity. That's the mantra of this month's guest on the Stillbirth Matters podcast. Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Duffy. This month, I was very lucky and fortunate to interview Dr. Jane Warland. In 1993, she experienced the unexplained full-term stillbirth of her daughter, Emma. Following that tragedy, Dr. Warland pursued academia for stillbirth prevention. Dr. Warland is a registered midwife and associate professor in midwifery at the University of South Australia. She is a passionate researcher into preventative and modifiable risk factors for stillbirth. She has published a textbook, book chapters, and journal articles, and has presented her research at numerous national and international conferences. Dr. Warland was recently honored with the Star Legacy Foundation's Research Star Award in 2017, and we are so grateful that she took the time to speak with us. Well, Dr. Warland, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
My first question is around fetal movement, and we hear a lot about monitoring fetal movement, especially here in the United States, but my question for you is, what does the literature say about fetal movement, and what is it important for pregnant women to know?
I think one of the biggest points that maternity care providers need to make to pregnant women is that every baby is different, and the pregnant woman knows her baby best. So that's what pregnant women need to know. With respect to what literature tells us, as far back as 2008, Alex Heasel and Fred Frohen published a paper about methods of fetal movement counting, and they said that that we really shouldn't be trying to prescribe any kind of alarm limit. And even so, it's still really very widely held belief across the globe that a baby needs to move 10 times in a period of time. And that period of time varies widely, so you kind of pick one, really. It can be 10 in an hour, 10 in 2 hours, 10 in 4 hours, 10 in 12 hours, 10 in 24 hours, or anything in between. But if you think about it, it actually really doesn't make any sense at all that babies will move the same amount any more than it makes sense for a new mum of a new baby to be standing there looking at how often her baby moves in order to reassure her that her baby is well or not. Everybody moves differently, and some are more active than others. So that takes me back to the point that I made, that every baby is different and that pregnant woman really does know her baby best.
When it comes to you and your patients, what do you tell your patients specifically about monitoring fetal movement?
Yeah, so I think all care providers need to have a conversation in the middle of pregnancy. And it needs to go something like this. getting to know your unborn baby is a really good way of knowing that your baby is well. So I would say something like, from now until the end of the pregnancy, I'm going to ask you at each visit about your baby's movements. And you need to tell me about how your baby is, who your baby is, and to immediately tell me if there's a change. So what I mean by that is that every baby's different and has a different personality that you can learn and get to know before your baby's born. So some babies are morning people and always will wake you up with a flurry of activity in the morning. And others are evening people and they'll stop you from going to sleep at night with all the kicking that they're doing. Some are really social people and really like to kick when someone they know who's talking is in the room. Others will kick along to music. Others won't like you to play music and will want you to keep quiet. So if you get to know your baby, then if your baby's behaviour changes, that's something that I need to know as your care provider. So if you notice any changes, I need to know that immediately, not at the next visit, not the next day, but right when it happens. And then together we can work together to keep your baby safe.
you've been a leader on the STARS study that was created at the STAR Legacy Foundation's first stillbirth summit back in 2011. What can you tell us about this study and some of the findings that have come from it so far?
So the study was an international internet survey, which we conducted between 2012, which was shortly after that summit in 2011. We finished it recruiting in, I think, late 2015. The survey questions mainly came from the bereaved parents and the researchers who attended that first summit. So that made it quite unique because it really was the first time that bereaved parents had the opportunity to say, hey, I wonder about this. The study was a cohort study with a nested case control arm, and the cohort involved more than 1,700 women. And they had had a stillbirth more than 3 weeks before, up to 30 years before. And the nested case control study had 153 people who'd had a stillbirth less than 3 weeks ago, and 480 live-born controls who'd had either an ongoing pregnancy at the time that they answered the survey or had had a living baby born in the last 3 weeks. So we've published the main findings from the cohort study in BMC Pregnancy and Childbirth, and that's an open access journal, meaning that anyone can access it and read it without cost. So if you Google my surname, stillbirth and STARS, it'll come up and you can have a read of it. We tried to make the language of it as accessible as possible, so I think that most people would be able to read it and understand it. But with respect to the findings, we mainly reported on the fetal movements, gut instinct and time of death. So with respect to the fetal movements, we found that nearly two-thirds of the cohort reported changes in fetal movement, which really wasn't surprising. We've known for a long time that changes in fetal movement are quite reflective of a pregnancy in trouble. While this was expected, it was probably a little bit surprising that we had over 16% of those cases tell us that the change was an increase. Some of the women ticked both increase and decrease. So that puzzled us for a bit, and I'll talk about how that played out, I guess, with the case control studies in a minute. The response to the change was also quite concerning. So we reported that a lot of the cohort didn't actually worry about the change at all, or they told a family member and then they didn't worry any further. They mentioned it to their care provider and they were reassured. So 30% of the cohort said that, which was really very concerning. 8% were told to monitor at home and then ring back if they were concerned. So that's what the old, you know, take a drink of cold water and ring me back if the baby doesn't start moving. So added together, we had about 61% who didn't really have a good evidence-based response to the importance of monitoring fetal movements, whether that be from their own knowledge or from their care provider's knowledge. So that is pretty concerning, and we've talked about that a little bit more with the paper that we've just written that's under review from the case control findings, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a tick. Getting back to the cohort, the gut instinct question was really interesting. And again, this question came from parents at the summit who put up their hand and said, hey, I had a gut instinct that something was wrong with the baby right throughout the pregnancy. And lots of other people in the room said, hey, so did I. So we actually asked about it. And in the cohort, we had 65% of them say, yes, I had a gut instinct that something was wrong in the pregnancy. Interestingly, slightly more people who are having their first baby said this. So that kind of put paid to the theory that this might have come from experience, that we might see it more often in the people having their second or subsequent baby, but that actually wasn't the case. And then we also tested how consistent this was over time, and we found that it really didn't matter who you looked at, that the recall of this was consistent over many years. Then we asked about time of death, which gave us an interesting finding, because 40% of the people who'd had a baby die said that they thought their baby died overnight, and that kind of goes in with the sleep position at night research, which is coming out. And then finally, with the respect to the cohort data, we had lots of the mums, 33% of them actually, sorry, 55% of them, believe that the cause of death was different from what they had been told the cause of death was. And this was particularly true for people who had had an unexplained stillbirth. So with the case control data, I reported some of these findings at the most recent stomach that we've just had in Minneapolis, but I'll talk about it again now. So we had the fetal movement information, but as I said, we've got a paper currently under review. We found that the live-born controls were much more likely to keep track of their baby's movements and also to be told to keep track of their baby's movements by their care provider. They also reported in the last 2 weeks of the pregnancy increased strength and frequency in their baby's movements, infrequent hiccups, and frequent episodes of vigorous fetal movements, so lots of times when the baby moved vigorously. On the other hand, the cases were much more likely to say that their baby decreased in both strength and frequency in the last 2 weeks of pregnancy, that they had frequent, lengthy, daily episodes of fetal hiccups, and that they also reported a single episode of excessive, vigorous fetal activity, which they described using words like crazy, frantic, wild, ballistic, nuts. We think this is what the cohort mums were talking about when they said that their baby's movements decreased and that they also ticked increased, that they were actually just saying we had one episode where the baby went crazy. And interestingly, this is a finding that Thomasina Stacey found in her Auckland stillbirth study, which she reported in 2011, where they found a sevenfold increased risk of stillbirth if there was a single episode of vigorous fetal activity. With respect to the gut instinct question, we found 75% of the stillborn cases said that they had a gut instinct that something was wrong in the pregnancy versus only 12% of the controls. So that was strongly statistically significant. And with respect to sleep, we had the stillborn cases report longer nighttime sleeping duration, better sleep quality than the controls. And the controls were much more likely to say they had a very restless sleep on the last night of their pregnancy. So the supine sleep, unfortunately, we had too few people say that they fell asleep supine to be able to actually assess any effect of supine sleep in our particular case control study. So that's it in a nutshell. a lot to take in, I guess.
Well, that's fascinating, and thank you for sharing such thorough information about that study. Let's shift the conversation a little bit to the stigma and the taboo around stillbirth. It's a major challenge for stillbirth prevention. That's what we find here in the United States. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. And if so, how can stigma surrounding stillbirth be addressed?
Yeah, I agree. Stigma and taboo are really widespread. In fact, we know that these are global issues. Interestingly, one of the questions that was asked in the survey that Dr. Heasel reported on in the recent Stillbirth Lancet series asked this question. Parents should not talk about their stillborn baby because it makes people feel uncomfortable. And actually more than 40% of the parents who contributed to that study, whether they were from low or middle income countries, said yes to that. So that's, I guess, one indicator that we have a problem. I also currently have a PhD student who's looking at stillbirth and stigma. And she has already found in a pilot study of 100 bereaved people, my mums and dads, that 33% of them reported feeling stigmatised in that they felt unable to openly talk about their baby. Or that family and friends and society had minimised their experiences, and that some even felt discriminated against, openly discriminated against. So you're right, dealing with stigma is really important, and it's important because care providers, it keeps care providers silent, and if they stay silent about stillbirth, then they really don't have an opportunity to talk to the pregnant mum about ways to keep her unborn baby safe. And this has the potential to result in a preventable stillbirth. So if you talk to pregnant women about things that they need to watch out for to prevent stillbirth, then that logically helps to prevent stillbirth. I think we have a lot of work to do regarding how to address stigma and taboo. And it's because we are trying to change society's view about death in a death-denying society. So that's really tricky, but I do think it can be done. And we only have to look at the SIDS Back to Sleep campaigns to know that it can be done. So public awareness around talking about baby death with respect to SIDS and putting the baby on their back to sleep has resulted in widespread reduction in SIDS. I think that in lots of ways we just need to bite the bullet and actually do it. And certainly organisations like Tommy's in the UK are leading the way in this space. So if you go to the Tommy's website and have a look at some of their videos and education materials, they really are quite outstanding, and I think that they're showing the way, and we really just need to adopt what they're doing and do it too.
To make such a profound societal shift when it comes to stigma and things like that, it takes a lot of time, I would imagine. And I'm just curious, from a personal perspective, have you noticed improvements since 1993, when you first entered this space, when you lost your daughter Emma to stillbirth?
Yes and no. I guess one of the things that I have noticed, and it's certainly been more recently than 1993, is that there's much more talk about stillbirth, where people are becoming more willing to mention it, to talk about it, and to talk about ways of preventing it.
You were here in Minneapolis just last month in June, and you spoke at the Stillbirth Summit. And during your speech, you addressed many of the myths that exist in obstetrics. For those who weren't at the summit, can you just kind of talk a little bit about these myths and the science that has proven them wrong?
So those myths were to do with fetal movements. So I've already mentioned the commonly held one that babies move 10 times in a period of time. There are two more that I talked about at the summit, and I'd really love the opportunity to talk further about them here to really bust them. And that is that the baby's slow movements towards the end of the pregnancy, because they are running out of room, quote, or perhaps they are, quote, getting ready for birth. That's completely and absolutely wrong. In fact, we found in the STARS study that the controls, the live-born controls, were much more likely to say that their baby continue to move strongly, more frequently and more powerfully as the pregnancy went on. And that makes sense. You know, if you're strong, then you're not going to move less. You're going to continue to move the same or even more. In fact, we've got lots of papers that talk about the fact that babies don't move less close to term, and that in fact, if they do, that this is putting you at increased risk, massive increased risk actually of stillbirth. There really isn't any weight to that myth at all. And I think Alex at the summit used a really great analogy, which I'd like to use again here. And that is that decreased fetal movements is not unlike chest pain. It's a symptom that all might not be well. And Alex pointed out that if you have chest pain, only 4% of those people will actually be having a heart attack. and yet no one in the world would say to someone who's experiencing chest pain, well, that's all right, don't worry about that, it's probably nothing. Every single time it's going to be investigated and properly investigated. Whereas we've got 30% of people experiencing reduced fetal movements who are likely to go on to have a problem, either their baby is born small or if their baby is born still. So 30%. So that's quite a high number for us to be rolling our eyes or, you know, looking at a pregnant woman and saying, oh, you're just being anxious, don't worry about that. So I think that if we know that women presenting with decreased fetal movements have a significantly higher chance that something might actually be wrong with their baby, we can't be rolling our eyes at them. We need to actually be starting to treat reports of decreased fetal movements just as seriously as an emergency care provider does someone who's complaining of chest pain, and that's fully investigating it and making sure that that baby is safe and well. The other myth is drinking a cold sugary drink will somehow cause the baby to move. And the theory behind this is that the cold drink will cause the stomach to rumble and wake the baby up, and that the sugary drink is supposed to give the baby a sugar burst and give it energy to move. Now, I'd like to stress that neither of these theories is even remotely physiologically plausible. So having a cold drink can't possibly wake a baby when the cold drink goes into the stomach and the uterus is at least 10 centimetres away from where that cold water hits the stomach. And even if it does make the stomach rumble, to the extent that it might wake up the baby, then we've really, you know, what's the point of that? with respect to sugar, if the mother has a sugar load, her insulin deals with that and it doesn't go through to the baby. And if it does, then it actually causes the baby to make the baby big. So that happens in diabetes, and it's not a good thing. So there is no way that sugar can give. If the mother ingests sugar, it can't wake the baby up. So both of these, this advice, I guess, is really incredibly dangerous. And I'd like to use an analogy to really try and hit this home, and that is if you imagine that the mother of a toddler rings her paediatrician and says to him or her, I'm really worried about Johnny because he's been lying around on the couch all day and he's not moving much. So imagine if the paediatrician said, that's okay, just go and bang a drum next to his ear and see if it makes him move. And if it does, then don't worry, he's fine. Likewise, if the same mum said, I'm really worried, and the paediatrician said, oh, don't worry about that, just give him a cold sugary drink, and if he moves, he's okay. I think it's easy to see, using that analogy, how totally ridiculous it is to give this advice. Because even if it was somehow possible that you could actually make the baby move using these strategies, you are not going to make the baby well. So as a strategy, at best, it delays the woman from seeking care, and at worst, it puts the baby's life at risk. And if you remember from the STARS study, more than a third of the cohort were reassured by their care provider, and that while, of course, we can't possibly know how many of those stillbirths might have been prevented, instead of fobbing the woman off with nonsense, if they were actually seen and properly assessed, it'd be quite reasonable to say that many of those stillbirths were probably preventable.
So we've talked about stigma, and we've talked about myths, and I want to conclude this conversation by talking about the very inspiring speech that you gave at the Stillbirth Summit this year, which was about your dream. It was, I have a dream. And basically, your dream is all around stillbirth prevention and living in a day where we don't have to have the conversations that we're having right now, because stillbirth prevention is happening. This is a big question, but I'd love for you to summarize maybe one or two of the components of your dream on what we can do as providers and families and just as a community to make stillbirth prevention possible.
Thank you for that. I guess with respect to my dream, I think I said at the end of my speech that I gave a call to arms, I guess in that call to arms I said that raising public awareness of stillbirth needs to happen through education campaigns, and that Tommy's was leading the way with this, and that we really need to take a leaf out of their book and just copy what they're doing and do what they're doing. I think that care providers need to start taking stillbirth and stillbirth prevention very seriously. And I was delighted to hear when Alex was talking to you a couple of weeks back in his podcast that he's managing a high-risk pregnancy clinic where all of the women who he sees are at least 5 times increased risk of stillbirth and probably more with other risk factors that they have. And yet he hasn't had a single stillbirth in his clinic. And why is that? Well, it's because he takes stillbirth seriously and he takes steps to monitor the pregnancy and look after the pregnancy from the beginning to the end. So I think that we need to take a leaf out of his book and do the same thing for every pregnancy. And we'll probably have similar results to his if we did that. I think that we need to take pregnant women seriously too. They know their baby best. They're not stupid. They're not weak. Being treated as if they're silly or anxious or that mother disempowers them from actually protecting their baby, which is concerning, because we don't need to do that. We actually need to do the opposite. Empowering women to look after their baby is, in fact, quite easy to do. It really just goes to trusting her, supporting her, listening to her, and immediately responding to her. So I truly believe that if we did all of those things, that we can make a big hole in the numbers of preventable stillbirths worldwide.
Well, Dr. Worland, I really want to thank you for taking the time and to share your thoughts with us. And most importantly, I don't think our listeners know the time differential. In the Midwestern United States, it's 4:30 right now, and it's, what, 7 a.m. where you are?
It's just gone 7 o'clock, and I can hear the rooster crowing. Can you? Can you hear him?
I can't. I cannot hear the rooster. I wish I could. Well, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's all for this month's episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.